I think it's also very important that institutions that we run, even though they're very different now, take the role of actually supporting the younger voices, as we do need these spaces for criticality and for the possibility of speaking up, taking a risk, making the room available for new voices to take shape.
Herzlich willkommen zu Kunst in Berlin, dem Podcast der Berlinischen Galerie Museum für moderne Kunst. Mein Name ist Thomas Köhler, ich bin der Direktor des Hauses. In diesem Podcast treffe ich Künstlerinnen, die bei uns ausstellen und Menschen, die die Kunststadt Berlin prägen. Wir sprechen über moderne und zeitgenössische Kunst und die Arbeit in einem Museum. Kunst in Berlin wird präsentiert vom Förderverein der Berlinischen Galerie. Dear friends of Berlinische Galerie, welcome to episode number 15 of our podcast Art in Berlin. Our first episode in English, and there's a reason for that. My guest today is Tone Hansen, the director of the Munch Museum in Oslo. For our current exhibition, Edvard Munch, Magic of the North, we teamed up with the Norwegian Museum, which Tone has led since the end of last year. Our exhibition was only possible thanks to their support and the many loans we have been able to acquire from their museum. So thank you, Tone, again for coming to Berlin, for joining us today for the podcast. I'm glad to have you here. Have you always dreamt to become a museum director?
Never, I would say. I mean, it's one thing led to the other. So for me, running a museum is a result of a long investment in art and a deep love for visual art and for what art can do with society, to society, and together with society.
Well, I never dreamt of becoming a museum director either, I have to say, but it happened. So how did you start?
You know, I started as an artist, and growing up on the countryside of Norway, there's hardly any art to see at all. So literature and film was my way into the world of culture. And at one point I understood that visual art has this extreme freedom in it. You work on your own, you're your own boss, you're responsible for your own career, and the world can open up for you if you're good enough. I just started to learn about art and I became an artist after a long education. But immediately after, I understood the cost of that freedom, which is very little money. And money aside, it's not the most important part of it, maybe, but the lack of colleagues or the ability to be so much alone. And I quickly learned that I was better actually at organizing others than myself. And that led me to become a curator.
Okay, but how did you switch? Germany is very, very conservative in that point. If you have studied art history, you stay art historian. If you're an artist, you stay an artist. And that's pretty strict. There's hardly any communication between these two fields. So how did you succeed to be accepted in the field of the elitist museum directors?
Well, I think I'm a product of the 90s, where limits were much more open than they might be even in Norway today. So it was possible to do a little bit here, a little bit there, and suddenly you got a position, you did something with art that maybe an art historian wouldn't do as a curator. I just think that the situation in the 90s were much more open, so it was possible to take a position and work from there.
Why has it changed so drastically? What do you think?
I don't know if it has changed dramatically, but Oslo and Norway has changed dramatically. As I'm now leading one of the biggest museums in Norway with more than 200 people, a lot of visitors and a totally new job to do than running a museum of maybe 20 people or 50 people. So it's a whole new situation with the Munch Museum, with the National Museum and the Astrup Fearnley and the opera and the whole kind of the city development of Oslo becoming much more of a cultural city with much more attention and interest in art. So I think the whole landscape, the whole kind of the macro picture of Oslo and Norway has changed dramatically. And that also leads to the need for more formalized education, maybe, when you enter into positions.
Okay. Well, before joining the Munk, you have been director of a very interesting art center, the Heini Onstad Art Center, which I love a lot because the architecture is very, well, flexible. You can do the most amazing shows there. So how long did you stay there and what was your strategy at Heini Onstad, which is not right in the center of Oslo, but a bit outside of the city?
That's true. The Heini Onstad is a very much of a product of the 60s. It opened in 68 and has a wonderful 60s architecture that is really fantastic. And it's the first private museum in Norway.
Yeah, who was Heini Onstad?
Sonja Heini was the most award-winning figure skater still in Norway. And she became a Hollywood star, made her money in Hollywood. She met the shipping magnate Nils Onstad and married him late in her life. They never got any children together and decided to start collecting art and build an art museum. So they came both from the US back to Norway with a philanthropic view that was not seen in Norway before. So they established this art center and gave the grounds for a fantastic collection also. And for me, the Heini Onstad was a fantastic place to combine modern and contemporary art. And with a special view on the historical avant-garde, Dada, also Fluxus. And pretty soon we also became the home of the largest collection of Kurzweilers outside of Germany, as Kurzweilers had a very strong relationship to Norway and came as a refugee also when he had to leave Germany. And then he had to leave Norway as well. But his take on Norway has been very important for rewriting the history and his role in it as wasn't done really much in his time.
I think so, we have been working together already when you were there. I think for a Dada project, if I remember correctly, I think we gave you some loans for a change.
You were most supportive for our Dada project. It was a crazy undertaking for a small institution as Heini Onstad. So yeah, I'm grateful for that support and equally grateful for being here today with our new collaborations.
Oh yeah, that's true. I mean, the Munk has changed drastically as well, I'd say. I mean, I remember this old building very fondly, I have to say, because it seemed to me quite okay, risk flexible. Of course, it did not offer the ideal conditions, I suppose, for the preservation and presentation of art. So what made you decide to change from that anything is possible, Heini Onstad Center for Art, to Munk, which is, it has a very heavy load.
It's a heavy load and a big step to take and a big undertaking also. But, you know, after 11 years in a position, it's limited what you can do. You stretch the limits as far as you can. And I think it's very healthy for the art world that people change positions from time to time.
Okay, I'm here for 15 years.
Oh, but this is such a good program here.
I'm not tired yet.
No, so I'm happy to hear that.
Don't discourage me.
But I mean, it's also kind of interesting to talk to you about programming because you have an equal interest in combining the historical with the contemporary, but also with the view of lifting younger artists and giving them a scene alongside a very good collection. So I'm curious about your strategy there.
Well, the founders of Berlinische Galerie, they have been very visionary, I'd say, because when they founded Berlinische Galerie in 1975, they wanted to be a counterpart to the National Gallery and the big names. They wanted to focus on the local art scene and on the art made in Berlin. And they decided to start at the end of the 19th century and, well, to encourage contemporary artists as well. So right from the beginning, it was part of the strategy to have classical modern art in the collection and in the exhibitions and, well, a contact to the art scene. And that was quite important in 1975 because West Berlin, Berlinische Galerie was founded in the West, had an excellent art school. But as soon as they graduated, the artists left Berlin because there was no real gallery scene. There were no exhibition places. So they would rather go to West Germany, where the collectors were, where the money was, and so on. So, but I'm quite happy that they kind of came up with that strategy in 75 because it still works today. So, and that's very inspiring. Every year, that's how we do our programming. We have a very interesting department, which is called the Artists' Archive. And the founding director of Berlinische Galerie said, well, anything what cannot stand on its own on a shelf has to go into the archives. So no books, but photographs, autographs, whatever you can think of. So this is this is a precious source for future generations of directors, I'd say, and for our program.
Yeah. So we and keep... for the artists as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Because being documented is also part of creating a narrative for the future.
Oh, exactly. So that's, in fact, the principle of our work here. And on the other hand, I mean, Berlin is so thriving and has such a huge art scene that we do not have any trouble finding artists who want to exhibit here. So it's a bit similar, I'm quite sure.
Yeah. I think it's also very important that institutions that we run, even though they're very different now, take the role of actually supporting the younger voices, as we do need these spaces for criticality and for the possibility of speaking up, taking a risk, making the room available for new voices to take shape. And if a modern institution like this can provide that shelter for a younger artist within a modernist tradition, I think it makes it even easier for them to take that position.
Well, museums tend to be rather slow because we have to have some planning. We have to plan our shows ahead. How do you deal with that? I mean, how can we become faster?
I mean, the wonder with the new museum in Oslo, the Munch Museum, is that we have 11 floors, exhibition spaces. So we can have very many programs running parallel. And I think that also gives us a good opportunity to be flexible in time, depending on what kind of exhibition you're making. You know, making an Edvard Munch exhibition here takes like 5-6 years in planning. And while working with contemporary artists, could happen in half a year, 1 year.
Oh, really?
One year.
Okay. Well, I mean, the fastest format we have is our video space. Yeah. And we used to have like 12 artists in that video space per year. Oh. And communication department was complaining all the time because they didn't really have the time to communicate the program. It was over when they started to communicate. So we have decided to extend these periods and have 2 months of presentation. Yeah. But still, this is the fastest format we have. All the other projects, they do need, well, at least a year, I'd say, in our case of preparation. Otherwise, it becomes too hectic.
Also for the artist, yeah. I mean. But I think it's some projects are running over maybe 5-6 years before they're completed, while working with contemporary art can be much quicker than that. And we have, similar to you, a solo Oslo program where we lift young artists from the city of Oslo, but living in or having a relationship to Oslo. And that's... a project where we develop new project together with them and also help them finance new work. So that's a good scene, I think, in parallel to Edvard Munch and the presentation of his work.
Do you work with the Art Academy in Oslo, or are they too young for your strategy?
Well, we could, but we don't really. Yes, they are too young. Yeah. And Oslo has a thriving art scene. It's so many smaller gallery spaces, both commercial and artist run. So there's a whole fantastic infrastructure for the art world. So there are possibilities to take step by step to become better.
And you've got that huge responsibility for the estate of Edvard Munch. I mean, how much is it, in fact? I mean, there must be an inventory, I suppose, because it's
huge.
A long time.
Yeah. It's Edvard Munch donated his collection to the city of Oslo in 1944, trusting the city more than the state. We now take care of this heritage. It's 1,200 paintings, more than 18,000 prints, 10,000 letters, and several photos as well. So it's a huge, huge collection. Two-thirds of what he produced is in our collection. So we are a major responsibility for the reputation of Edvard Munch.
Mm. Well, when we were thinking about realizing a project on Edvard Munch and Berlin, we were asking ourselves, well, is there still some research to do, or has he been thoroughly researched and there's nothing left? What's your approach? Do you have a research department?
We do have an innovation and research department developing and making sure that we are developing research ourselves, but also forcing us to innovate, to think in new ways in order to reach a new audience, but also to expand globally in terms of making Edvard Munch available also online. So that's a huge undertaking. But research is incredibly important, and I don't think you can ever be finished with Edvard Munch. So I'm so happy for the program or the project you developed here. And I've said it once and I'll say it again. I'm a little bit jealous of this idea of looking at Edvard Munch in Berlin, because it's an original idea to take him back. And it's so obvious still, as this is where he made started his career.
Now it seems so obvious to all of us, because who would have thought? And I think most of the visitors will be surprised as well to see how intense his time was in Berlin.
Yeah.
I do have another question regarding the research work, because we keep asking ourselves how research has to be today. I mean, mostly we are thinking about printed objects, about books, about a series of publications, about long
peer
shelves.
Reviews.
What do we do in the future? I mean, we still print catalogs. I suppose you do too. And they are sold. They sell very well. But what's the future of research? I mean, who is going to publish his PhD in a printed version? I mean, I didn't.
Big question. I think, first of all, research in a museum has a different role than in a museum. And we tend to think of research closer to exhibition making and, you know, also the catalogs and the peer review articles. So I think that we need to focus maybe even more on exhibition history. It's very interesting, you know, not only what we said about Munch, but how he was displayed or other kinds of exhibitions too. And I think there are a lot to investigate also in relationship to how Munch is understood in different societies, as I think the view of him, you would get quite surprised of how he's been seen. And then again, good curators do research. And I guess it's the same with you, how difficult it is to save enough time for people to do the research they need to be able to publish. And then when it comes to publishing, I still think that it's better to read a text on paper, at least a long text, and certainly a PhD. But online publishing is also making the world more democratic.
More accessible.
Absolutely. Ideas can travel so much more easily. While books are so heavy and the cost of sending a book today is more than printing it. So.
Yeah. Well, and are you trying to collect as well photographs of exhibitions, of Munch exhibitions abroad? Is it part of your archive?
We have a good photo archive, and if there's anything of interest that becomes available on auctions or on the private market, we evaluate it if it's necessary or not. But absolutely,
So last year, to prepare myself, I went to Paris and saw the big show at Musée d'Orsay, which was insanely packed with people. And as far as I remember, it was the first big monographic Munch show in France. Is that true? I mean, what about reception of Munch? Which countries were particularly interested in his work, apart from Germany? Can you say that?
Japan.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting for us to see that after opening the new museum that is only 2 years old, the new attention that the building created and the exhibitions we made of Edvard Munch created, the interest in him has exploded.
Ah.
But I'm very happy to participate and to collaborate in projects that are looking into and trying to find new insight into Munch and his work, rather than exhibiting the most classical and the most wanted work that he made.
I completely agree. I mean, there's so much to discover, I think, and most journalists who came to the press conference, I think they realized that it doesn't have to be the screen necessarily to understand Munch's work. But when it comes to contemporary art, well, how do you decide which contemporary artists or which topics are being combined with Munch, are being shown in your museum? Do you have, do you discuss it in a group, or is it you, the director, deciding? How do you do your program?
You know, the first thing you learn when you take over a big institution as Munch is that you don't know anything, but you have a staff that knows a lot. And all together we form an organism that can deal with multiple sorts of questions. So I'm totally dependent on my curators and their expertise. As a director, I wouldn't curate myself because it's too big of an institution. So there is groups of people coming together. All the curators work together. We have different kinds of sounding boards and program groups that are discussing ideas and developing them. And at the end, of course, it's a discussion of what we can do and what would be the best for the art scene today.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, museums, used to be, and most of them still are, pretty conservative institutions. I mean, born from the times of Enlightenment, they still represent a certain, well, sphere of society, mostly a well-educated crowd attending museums. I hope it has changed, and I think it has. But how do you deal with that challenge? I mean, attracting everybody, not only the art historians.
You know, I think the best thing you can do is to have a diverse program. As you know, that you can't say that there is only one audience. Audiences are experts in their own fields, in their own lives. So you have to cater for them by making your program relevant for a diverse group of people. So you need a diverse group of curators, but you also need a diverse program. And that's fantastic with the new Munch Museum, is that since we have so many floors, we can do a contemporary art exhibition. We have a triennial for new media that is completely talking about, you know, how art is changing due to technology. And we can, parallel to that, have a modernist exhibition, that, which is highly sought after and interesting for a different kind of audience. So I think we will succeed if we are able to talk to a different kind of audience all through the levels of the institution.
In our case, we have 60% of our visitors are foreigners. They're coming to Berlin as tourists, and they just checked the listing. So the rest, 40%, they're from Berlin.
Do your tourists come for your collection or for the...
Mostly for, and that's another challenge, I think, for us as museum directors, the temporary shows.
Really?
Yeah. So we do regular visitor research. So we know that they come, well, now they will be coming for Munch, of course. But some of them are coming for the collection as well. But that's very interesting. So that the tourist aspect for the Munch must be of a certain significance as well, because the building is very, I wouldn't say dominant, but it's remarkable. The whole seashore has changed, the opera, the National Museum, and so on. You can spend days exploring the collections. So how many people are coming from abroad? Do you know that, to see your shows?
I do. And it's a significant number of visitors all through summer, which is the most important period for the tourists. But for us, it's the opposite situation, because the tourists come for Edvard Munch.
That's true.
The local, over time, I think, will come for the program that we make during fall and spring. But so far, it's still Edvard Munch that is the eternal blockbuster for that house.
So I was very surprised when we had to close down the museum for an installation of a new sprinkler device. There was no museum, in fact. It was just the building, but it was closed. You couldn't enter it. And we had a program in front of the museum. And all of a sudden, the neighbors came. And they enjoyed being outside the museum even more than being inside, I think. I've never received so many positive feedback before. So probably there's still some kind of barrier for many people to enter a museum, or are we over that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's the Munch Museum has a huge outreach program in order to develop the next generation of museum goers, but also to make us relevant for the younger. And since I don't know what they want, we need to talk to them and learn from them. So we have a pioneering program where youth are invited in, employed to run and make their own program. So it's like a possibility to work besides school and to develop a program that is related to what your own interests and to your crowd. So a lot of interesting things come out of that are we wouldn't thought of ourselves. That are working really well. And I think you need to open up also for rethinking strategies when it comes to what is a program and how do you program a museum. And luckily, we have so many spaces so we can alter upon what we do, running a serious museum on the one side, but parallel to that, also having programs for younger.
In Berlin, they have started, I think, 1.5 years ago with these free Sundays. Every first Sunday in the month is a free Sunday. And it's very popular. Well, I thought in the beginning the same people would come. They just save some money and they don't have to spend anything on the entrance fee. But apparently, yes, that program succeeds in attracting people who hesitate to spend like 12 euros, 15 euros or 14 euros. So I think the entrance fee is an issue. How do you cope with that? Because, I mean, I can't remember the prices of Monk, but it seems to be an issue for many people.
It's quite similar to yours. First of all, we are free until 18.
Same here.
We are free every Wednesday after 6 till 9, which is the late night. The museum is open every day except one day a year, and that's May 1st. Absolutely every day is open. And that also makes it possible to come. You can come in the evening. You can come during the day. If you don't celebrate Christmas, you can come. And many people don't.
They don't celebrate Christmas, that's true. Yeah,
I think it's a wonderful thing to be open also when most other institutions are closed. Mm. We're open on Mondays too and Tuesdays, so it's a very open strategy. And I think that also makes it easier to come back and back, is that the long opening hours are making you more accessible. Mm. So I think that is helping a lot. And the newness of the building, of course, it's a huge attraction also. And the building is still an attraction for very many people.
I would think so, yes. I was most impressed when I read about your program, Monk Live. It seems to be very diverse in itself. So what do you do in that program?
The live program is organizing everything that is time-based. So it could be a lecture, it could be a seminar, it could be a performance. We have a lot of concerts. We have three spaces that can be used for concerts, lectures, or performances. So the house is built to be able to take and to provide with a lot of different experiences at the same time. And I think that music is also a way in for people, at least in Norway. Music is, people have more relationship to music than to visual arts. And I think that maybe going to a concert and then seeing a show afterwards is a way to get to know art and to familiarize with it.
Mm. You said maybe. I would agree, because that used to be a trend in museums to organize big events, parties, club nights.
Oh, we have club nights too.
I enjoy club nights a lot, but I'm asking myself, do these people go exclusively to the club nights, or are they coming back to see some Monk?
Oh, big question. But when we have a club night, the museum is open and it's for free and people
wander around,
yes. And I think we need to cater for different ways of seeing exhibitions too. Maybe people come to see The Vampire by Munch and then they're happy about that. And if you can come and go as that, I think it's a good thing.
So Munch came to Berlin, caused a scandal with his paintings in 1892. Are artists coming still today to Berlin? What's your impression of Norwegian artists?
Norwegian artists have been coming to Berlin for the last 20 years. So it's been a huge group of people living here and that have established themselves here, Scandinavian artists. So I think Berlin is as important for us today as it was in Munch's time.
Although even Berlin has changed a lot. It used to be some kind of, city of outcasts.
I loved coming to Berlin. I was first here in 89 at the Christmas, celebrated Christmas here. And that was an amazing experience to see a city that was on the burst of changing dramatically.
Yeah.
And then following the changes, it's quite incredible. But Berlin still has this kind of radical touch to it that I like. And there's so many good artists based here now.
Yeah, it's a city in transition. It's very woke. It's very political. And that's what I'm enjoying. Sometimes it's hard, I think. And there are many other institutions. So there's some competition in the city, which is good, I think. It's stimulating. It's not a competition in the true sense of the word, but it's complementing each other, I'd say, because each museum has its own profile. So how do you, do you communicate with the other directors? Because that's really rare, I think. And that's why I'm enjoying to talk to you so much.
Yeah.
You learn so much in these dialogues. But do you communicate with your colleagues in Oslo? Do you coordinate your programming or what kind of dialogue do you have?
Yes, absolutely. We do collaborate, especially with the National Museum that is bigger than us. But I think we have a responsibility for creating a possibility for collaboration, because we need also to make sure that we have a circulation within the audiences. As in Oslo, there is also so many things to do and see that it's hardly possible to see it all. And Berlin is impossible, so you have to make choices. But I think still we need to have a climate of collaboration rather than competition.
Is there a clash between like the state-run museums and the city museums?
No, I wouldn't say so. The Munch Museum is a city museum. It's paid for by the city of Oslo. So it's a huge responsibility to make art available for as many as possible in Oslo and to make ourselves as relevant as possible for the diverse population of Oslo, I must say.
Okay, my last question is about money.
Oh.
Yeah. So how do you get your funding? Do you have to have sponsors? Do you use the money you're making by entrance fees? Or, well, how does it work in Norway? How does it work in Oslo?
I don't have the numbers completely in my head, but I think we make 1/3 of the income ourselves. Ticket fees being the most important, but also we are totally dependent on having good supporters in terms of stiftungs or companies that are supporting us over a long time.
Okay, well.
But we are a city museum, and the most important sponsor of the museum is the city of Oslo.
Same here. So, but in our case, it's only 15% we have to make ourselves. So that's quite relaxing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Berlin is economically so weak. I mean, I tried in the beginning, actually, to find sponsors, but the amounts were not high enough. And it was, there's too much communication involved, you know, persuading companies to support the arts. And they, I'm not quite sure if they like to do so. But so we'll find out. It's just another way of communicating, perhaps.
I mean, if you go, I guess we don't have that tradition either in Norway, really. While if you go to the US, it's of course a totally different situation of friends and sponsors.
I prefer our systems, I have to say, because I think there's so much pressure and there's so many traps.
It
on
is
the
a
way.
Lot.
So, I mean, the movie on Nan Goldin's work proves that in a way, you know, like you have to be very careful whose money you have
that's
in
true.
Your cash box.
Yeah. No, I think it's incredible that the city of Oslo actually decided to build this museum and is also financing it in the way they're doing. And it's a huge privilege to be allowed to make this organism work for the best of the city of Oslo.
Absolutely. And we do not have to have too many lunches to raise the money. And that's a very, very big privilege as well, I'd say. You know, we're in charge of strategy, of program, of content, and not necessarily of budgets. And that's, yeah, comforting in a way. It's an ideal situation, I think. Well, thank you for coming today. Thank you for talking. And I hope to see you again soon. I think our project will be realized in Oslo in 26, if I am correct, when you are going to show a show which will focus on, well, the Berlin scene in a way. So we will continue our collaboration, which is fantastic.
We will indeed. And I'm so much looking forward to diving into the in-between war period and to see what kind of exhibition we can make that is relevant for both Edvard Munch, but also for the audience in Oslo.
Oh, and for both museums too, I think. It's very stimulating to work with another museum. And so we're learning a lot from you.
Yeah.
And that's probably the best part of these collaborations. It's very
absolutely
reciprocal, if that word exists in English. I don't know.
It does. Happy to make new friends.
Exactly.
Thomas.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Ja, die Ausstellung Edvard Munch, Zauber des Nordens, ist noch bis zum 22. Januar 2024 in der Berlinischen Galerie zu sehen. Und sollten Sie mal in Oslo sein, ich kann Ihnen eine Reise nur empfehlen, besuchen Sie unbedingt auch das Munch. In der nächsten Folge unseres Podcasts geht's dann um das Programm Cream Cake, das wir Ende Oktober in unserem IBB-Videoraum realisieren. Vielen Dank.